A grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Human Kinetics Publishers Incorporated, Champaign; Devro TPAC, Danville; and Illinois Graphics Incorporated, Bloomington. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Our guest today, writer Rachel Cohen. We're going to talk with her about her journey into American history, arts, and letters. Rachel Cohen is the author of A Chance Meeting, Intertwined Lives of American Writers and Artists, 1854 to 1967. The book begins with Henry James and his father in the studio of Matthew Brady. It closes with Norman Mailer and Robert Lowell sharing mugs of bourbon in Washington ahead of a march on the Pentagon to protest the Vietnam War. In between, you'll find stories of Willa Cather, W.E.B. Du Bois, Zora Neale Hurston, Joseph Cornell, John Cage, and Marianne Moore, among others. Rachel Cohen says these lives came and went during the fruitful, difficult period that held two related struggles, the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement. Let me quote further from the introduction to A Chance Meeting. "The 30 people gathered here met in ordinary ways, a careful arrangement after long admiration, a friend's casual introduction, or because they both just happened to be standing near the drinks. Some of their encounters left a memorable impression, though they never spoke again. On other occasions, strong and altering loyalties emerged, permanent conditions of influence were established, and acts of rebellion were set in motion. Writing of their own lives, they very often identified the crucial shifts as having happened in the moment of going through a new door or in the grasp of an unfamiliar hand." Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Rachel Cohen, has written for many publications, including The New Yorker. Her essays appeared in Best American Essays 2003 and the 2003 Pushcart Anthology. She won the 2003 Penn Gerard Fund Award for the manuscript of A Chance Meeting, and she teaches at Sarah Lawrence College. A Chance Meeting is published by Random House. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Rachel Cohen, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks so much for having me.
You say many of the people gathered here in A Chance Meeting began keeping you company a decade ago. You were driving around the U.S. and you were traveling with lots of books. Tell us about that year and the books you packed for the journey.
Yeah, it was an interesting year. It was a year where I thought that I was going to write a book sort of like John Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie, or anyway, that was my great dream. And so I was driving around looking for the kind of stories that he found and told in that book. And I found that I wasn't John Steinbeck, and that I certainly couldn't tell that story. And instead, I was reading all the books in my trunk, and I had Mark Twain because I was going to drive down the Mississippi, and I had a lot of Willa Cather, and then I bought books along the way in all the used bookstores I encountered, and gradually I accumulated this other set of American stories.
Yeah, well, you're a very good storyteller.
Oh, thank you. That's kind.
I've really enjoyed reading the stories that you tell in this book. You say that when you were reading those books on that year traveling around, you were reading them differently. You were reading them in a different way than you had read in the past. You were really interested in who those people were, who mm-hmm. those writers were. What inspired that new consideration of writers and artists?
I think I was myself trying to be a writer, so of course I was looking for models for how people did things and how they lived and how work got made. But I also think that it was a moment where I was very much in need of a certain kind of company. And for many readers, I think books are company of different kinds in different moments. And sometimes it's the characters who keep us company, and sometimes it's the writers themselves.
Mm. And when did you begin to realize that many of the people whose work you were reading had known one another?
I went to Vicksburg, to the battlefield there, and I bought Ulysses Grant's memoirs. And in the introduction it says that they had been published by Mark Twain. And I thought that was the strangest thing. I just couldn't believe it. I didn't have any sense that the author of Huck Finn had known the victor at Appomattox. And so I sort of went searching into that, and the more I looked, the more I realized that, in fact, you know, Willa Cather had been at Mark Twain's 70th birthday party, and Mark Twain had been friends with William Dean Howells, who had also edited Henry James, and that all of these people were interconnected in these different ways.
Yeah, I didn't know that Grant and Twain were not only business partners in the publishing venture, but they were good friends, weren't they?
They were good friends. They had real admiration for each other. Grant loved Twain's book, Innocents Abroad, and when he went abroad, he traveled with it. And Twain thought Grant was the most admirable, sort of huge figure of his time. They really had a close friendship in lots of ways.
Yeah. The period that you cover here, 1854 to 1967, that's a lot of time, at least it seems so to me, more than 100 years. How did you decide which chance meetings you'd like to consider?
It was really hard because there were so many interesting
yeah.
stories, and it seemed so necessary to have them all. So that winnowing process took years, actually, of putting things in and taking them out again. But I knew I wanted to start around the time just before the Civil War, because I thought that was a moment where Americans were really self-conscious in a way that they hadn't been before that, and where American art was beginning to have its own stature and considerations that were different than it had had. And I knew I wanted to end around the time of the Civil Rights Movement because I felt that a lot of the divisions that turned up in the Civil War kind of turned up again in the Civil Rights Movement, and you could see a lot of the same questions returning to the country at that time. So that was one way of choosing, was to sort of stay within that framework and to think about the things which were affected by those events.
Yeah. I have one more question drawn from the introduction. James Baldwin and Henry James, you kept them in your mind throughout the research and writing of this book. Baldwin quoted James when he wrote in Paris what it meant to him to be an American. He knew James, but he never met him, and the same goes for you with most of these folks. What has it meant for you getting to know these writers and artists through their work and their lives?
It's been really interesting. I think to me it seems like every artist or writer puts a huge amount of his or her life into the act of making things and the act of making art. And so studying the lives was a way of understanding what the art meant to them and why they wanted to make it. And it seemed to me to be different in each case, that each person's conception of that was different. So, and then that they were all different again by who was studying them. Like James Baldwin's Henry James is different than mine. But the way that he understood James helps me to understand James for myself.
Hmm. Did it take you by surprise that there were so many generosities, so many kindnesses in the lives of these people?
In a way it did, although I think that's also what I was most interested in. So it was partly what I was looking for, was the ways in which people had helped each other both in artistic collaboration and just in saying, well done, you know, which everybody needs to hear sometimes.
Yeah.
But there were moments that I just was astonished by, where I thought, oh, I had no idea, say, that Mark Twain had no intention of writing Life on the Mississippi until William Dean Howells said, you know, I really think you would do that well.
And who was it that spurred Willa Cather to quit magazine work and to write novels?
Right. Her mentor, Sarah Orne Jewett, was incredibly important in making that decision. And Jewett said to her very wisely, you are not going to be able to do it if you stay in the office. You have got to get out into the world and write your novels. And she did.
There's also, though, some competitiveness here and there.
Inevitably.
Here and there and everywhere. I'm thinking of Mailer.
Yeah, Norman Mailer.
And Robert Lowell.
Yeah, they I think had a really interesting interaction. Just it, Mailer was incredibly competitive, and so was Lowell in his way. And Lowell was, to Mailer's mind, a Boston Brahmin with sort of generations of family behind him and impressive stature. And Mailer thought of himself as a Jew from Brooklyn with none of those things. And so when they met, he was really pugnacious with Lowell. But then gradually they started to have a lot of respect for each other, and that, I think, really emerges during the course of Mailer's book, Armies of the Night.
The first chapter is the chapter where we see Henry James and his father, Henry James Sr., in the studio of Matthew Brady. And the first chapter opens with a wonderful photograph of the two. Would you describe it for us?
Sure. It's the small Henry James, then about 11, standing on a box to make him a little higher, with his arm on sort of leaning on his father's shoulder, and his father is holding a cane and is bald. And there's something, I think, in Henry James's little expression that's very evocative. It's hard not to feel that the little boy is thinking about something. And many years later in his autobiography, when he wrote about that moment, he said that he was having this acute feeling of self-consciousness about his family and what it meant to that they were American. And that this was partly because he had on this jacket, which he had heard from a family friend recently, had too many buttons on it, and that this was an American impropriety in dress. And he then felt very uncomfortable in his jacket, as many people feel in photographs. And so that's the sort of beginning moment of the book, is that question of self-consciousness that he had.
Yeah. This carries through that question, I think, start to finish, is I would say, is the overriding theme.
Yeah.
The self-consciousness, what does it mean to be an American? It's something that I think we continue to grapple with over and over and over again.
Yeah, I at least to me that seemed right. It seemed like something that had preoccupied a lot of these artists. And for a long time, those definitions were always made in contradistinction to Europe. You said, I am not an English writer, or I am not a French one, and that somehow makes me an American one. But even that, I think, is harder to sustain in our current world, which is so multidimensional. And so it's very hard to figure out what it is to be an American writer.
Yeah. Henry James became an English citizen.
Yeah, he did. Right in during World War I, when he felt that the United States should have entered the war, and he just despaired. He felt it was a huge lack of humanitarianism to have stayed out of international affairs as they had done. And so he became an English citizen at that point, having lived in England for a long time. But he really always thought of himself as an American novelist.
Mm. The poet Marianne Moore appears in this essay. She's here because of her essay, Henry James as a Characteristic American.
Mm-hmm.
What
mm-hmm.
pulled her toward James?
I think primarily or first his language, that she's a masterful user of words, Marianne Moore, and I think she loved the way James used language. And also again, self-consciousness, a kind of turning inward and turning over certain possibilities that she also is a ruminator in some ways in her work. And I think she wanted him to be part of the American tradition. That was really important to her. She wanted him to be part of her American tradition. And that was partly why she wrote that essay.
Mm. Well, jumping ahead to Marianne Moore and the artist Joseph Cornell now, if we could. I had no idea that they had such a friendship. You know, it was a delightful surprise. Oh. What would you like to say about these two and their relationship?
The way they knew each other.
Yeah.
That was one that also came as a delight to me, because once I knew about it, they seemed so perfect for each other.
Yeah.
I didn't realize until I started reading the correspondence of each of them that they had known each other. Joseph Cornell was an incredible collector. That was really how he made his art, by going and picking up treasures in secondhand stores and cutting paper pictures out of magazines and assembling those into his wonderful boxes. And Marianne Moore was like that too. She was really, she was a magpie. She collected quotations and she collected things from old books and she collected things from movies and from the zoo and all kinds of places. And so they just had a very common sensibility. But then they were both very shy and each lived with his or her mother and they barely went out sometimes. And so it was a very tentative friendship in certain ways and an incredibly formal and polite one.
Mm. It seems to me that in recently here we've seen new interest in the work of Joseph Cornell, and Marianne Moore is once again appearing on bookshelves in bookstores. For a long time, I think these two were relatively lost. What do you suppose is going on with that? Would you make the same observation?
Yeah, I think that's true. Part of it is just the way people inevitably go in and out of a sort of fame, and part of it is the sort of hazards of book publishing. Is there an in-print collected edition? That the recent Marianne Moore collected is certainly reminds people of her existence. But I think also there's something about their sensibility, about the erudition that they both had and the strangeness of the collections that each made that isn't to the taste of every moment, and maybe is particularly to our taste right now.
Mm. And Marianne Moore was a supporter of the war in Vietnam. I wonder if that cost her.
Certainly politically, she was on the right in a moment when people turned more toward the left, people in the arts turned more toward the left, and that may be difficult. But she was wildly popular in her late period, in her old age. And then really, really fell off. I think it's very hard to be a famous woman writer. It was interesting to me in going back how many really fine women writers had faded from view.
Mm. Do you think that's why we don't have many women who've written travel narratives? That's what you set out to do here.
It's a related but slightly different problem. It takes a great deal of confidence to impose a narrative on a landscape. I think that's a really difficult thing to do. And I think it does come more easily to men than to women to sort of be in that position. And then there are some actual practical things that it's, there are issues of safety. So that I think it can be harder. There are some fine women travel writers, but not nearly as many as men.
And maybe it is that they don't cover a large landscape, but they focus closer to home or in one particular area.
Yeah, and maybe stay longer also. Like there are, for example, fantastic letters of Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, who went to live in Turkey with her husband in, I think, the 18th century. But she stayed in one place and wrote her letters from there. And that may be a little bit more the woman's style of traveling, if there are gendered styles.
Mm. Makes me want to pack suitcases of books and go off somewhere. Not so much to move around.
And see what you discover.
Yeah.
It's a good thing to do. I recommend it. Yeah.
Of all the encounters here, of all the chance meetings, of all the friendships, are you equally fond of all of them, or do you have your favorites?
Oh, I have my favorites, although I love many. I would say all of them in different ways and sort of couldn't do without any of them. But there are people who are closer to my heart in one way or another. Henry James, I think, is someone like that. I really just keep going back to his work and keep trying to fathom it and feel that I haven't and find that satisfying. And Joseph Cornell is someone whose work I love. And then there are people whose appearance I really enjoy in this. Like, I really enjoy Charlie Chaplin walking into Hart Crane's bedroom in the middle of the night because they were all going to go out drinking, and Hart Crane just getting so thrilled and excited to see Charlie Chaplin. And that moment, that sort of shock of Charlie Chaplin coming through the door is a favorite moment of mine.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was fascinating to read about William James and W.E.B. Du Bois.
Yeah, that is a really interesting moment, I think, when William James was the professor of both Gertrude Stein and W.E.B. Du Bois. And they both learned an enormous amount from him, and they went on to be so influential in completely different circles and areas. He had a lot of students who were very devoted to him, and he really seemed to be able to do that thing that great teachers can do of just making you feel that you want to go further and know more and be more yourself. And then W.E.B. Du Bois really had a profound impact on basically a century of political and philosophical history. And you can see roots of that in his interactions with William James.
Yeah. Tell the story about William James and W.E.B. Du Bois going to see Helen Keller.
Helen Keller. Isn't that incredible? Yeah, because it was a thing that people did in that moment in the 1890s. They went out to see Helen Keller, who was this phenomenon that she could kind of communicate with people even though she couldn't see and couldn't hear. And so, and she was in an institute near Cambridge, near where they were, and so they spent the day together going out to visit Helen Keller and coming back, and they were very impressed by her and her teacher and Anne Sullivan, and they both remembered the event for a long time, and Helen Keller remembered it too and actually sent birthday greetings to W.E.B. Du Bois, I think about 70 years later.
Do you think it had some impact on his development of the idea of double consciousness?
It might have. I think certainly the sort of psychological teachings of William James were part of that. The phrase double consciousness was in use in psychology at that moment, and that was part of, I think, where he came to it. And certainly he was always very interested in different people's experiences of the world, and he would have, I think, related to Helen Keller's being in the world and yet not quite being able to be in the world because of her sort of different sensory experience.
Yeah. You, there's something that you write at the end of that essay. It is about, forgive me, it is either William James or Du Bois in terms of, and maybe you've taken a little political license here in this idea of imaginative nonfiction, which maybe we can talk about in a moment, but you talk about these two men meeting Helen Keller and then the idea of holding language in your hands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's there's no documentary evidence that they thought that, but the way that Helen Keller and Annie Sullivan communicated was by making signs that they pressed into each other's hands.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would obviously have been something that they would have experience that day, watching that communication happen, and they were both very interested in the sort of communication that's possible between people and the different forms it can take. And I'm very interested in the sort of fact of shaking somebody's hand, or in this extreme case, making language with your hands, and what kind of communication is possible.
Yeah. Now, as an essayist in writing these encounters, how did you make the distinction of fleshing things out and maybe going too far? Was that a concern of yours?
Absolutely it was. It was, yeah. I felt that I needed to be able to imagine just a little bit because I wanted to convey an effect of immediacy, of the feeling of being in a room with somebody. I thought that was important to the whole endeavor. But on the other hand, I didn't want to make things up that were out of character or that seemed presumptuous. So I was constantly checking everything and trying to see if I had the right sources and if things were close enough that it seemed I could say them. And I would get outside confirmation, and that would be reassuring. Like I in one piece, I have Elizabeth Bishop being late for Marianne Moore, and she's very worried about being late, and Elizabeth Bishop was, in fact, often late. And but I wasn't sure if that was the right way to begin. And then I found a letter from Marianne Moore saying that she really liked Elizabeth Bishop, but she particularly hated that she was always late. And then I thought, oh, this is a good sign for what I've invented. And then I've read an essay by George Plimpton in which he said that Marianne Moore was so obsessed with being on time that she always wore two watches. And so then I thought, well, this is fine. This is completely in character that Marianne Moore would be early and Elizabeth Bishop would be late, and this is the right sort of way to open their scene together. But it took a lot of pieces of evidence for me to feel sure that I had done my imagining well.
Yeah. I really enjoy reading the form of the essay.
Thanks.
And I wonder what it's like, what kind of satisfaction does an essayist get from writing an essay?
Oh, what a nice question. Yeah, I think the essay form is my favorite form. I love it, and I think it doesn't get talked about that much. There are a lot of different satisfactions. You can get quite close to the pleasures of a short story, of a narrative shape, an arc in which things happen to characters, or there are turns of story that are satisfying in the way that a fiction writer would have. And you can also make an argument, kind of build something persuasive, and that is quite different. And you can do a sort of fragmented collage kind of form, and that has different pleasures again. So it's really, I think, a marvelous and flexible form
in that way. I think it's almost as if the essayist is whispering to his or her reader, in a sense, because it's also the essay, the form, I think, it reveals things about the essayist.
I think that's exactly right. Even when it's not a personal essay, there's always a clear voice, and there are decisions about what's included and what's not included that indicate who the person is who's writing. I think it's a very conversational form, and has for a long, long time been close to letter writing as a form. Though the letter is to a more general reader, not to one specific reader.
Writer and essayist Rachel Cohen is our guest here this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of A Chance Meeting, Intertwined Lives of American Writers and Artists, 1854 to 1967. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. You can join the discussion with the telephone call. Join us with your questions and comments. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, let's go back in time. Let's go back to the second chapter now of A Chance Meeting. Here, boy, what a circle of people. We've got William Dean Howells. The focus is on William Dean Howells, Annie Adams Fields, and Walt Whitman, but there are many other luminaries here. Nathaniel Hawthorne, for example. We have Nathaniel Hawthorne in Boston telling Howells, who was from Ohio, how he'd like to go to Ohio, that is, Hawthorne would, because, quote, the damned shadow of Europe hadn't fallen there. And continuing on reading that essay, I wonder how Howells thought of that, because he is a seeker of, I think, of things European.
Especially at that point, when he's a young man, I think about 20, and just coming east for the first time to the centers of culture that he's been reading about in Ohio all this time. And so, yeah, they kind of met at opposite moments. Hawthorne, much later in his life, having seen plenty of Europe and now really wanting to move away from that shadow, and Howells on his way to it. Later, I think Howells would understand much better what Hawthorne had meant, but in that moment, I think he must have been surprised.
And Howells, how did his view of Walt Whitman change over time?
When he actually reviewed a fairly early edition of Leaves of Grass, and he didn't really like it. He was a little scandalized by it. And he was always the person who didn't want to talk too much about sex, so he really thought Whitman was out there in that way, but gradually over the years, he sort of realized that Whitman was an unbelievable poet, and came to feel that he was one of America's finest writers. But Howells had this extremely influential magazine, The Atlantic, that he was the editor of for more than a decade, and he published really everybody there. He published Twain, and he published Henry James, and he published Sarah Orne Jewett, and he never published Whitman. So there's a way in which he never quite came all the way around.
Yeah. It's interesting today, I think, that most of us would feel, if we were to describe ourselves as a Howells American or a Whitman American, we'd fall into the camp, probably, most of us, of being Whitman, more like Whitman Americans.
That's how we would think of ourselves?
Yeah.
Yeah. Although, in fact, I think probably a lot of us are Howells Americans. I mean, what Howells wrote about were domestic establishments, families, very often middle-class families who were struggling to understand the world and sometimes facing divorce and trying to kind of raise children and not get too absorbed by money and stay sympathetic to the working class people that they knew. And all of those things are struggles that we all, I think, still have. But we don't know that Howells wrote the novels about it 100 years ago.
Yeah. Well, I have not read William Dean Howells.
Neither have most people. But he's a fine novelist and a very sympathetic person and an excellent critic. So, yeah, he's worth reading.
Hmm. Over the course of these years, 1854 to 1967, what impact does technology and industrialization have on the character of America?
It makes a difference. I think one of the preoccupations throughout this book is the question of social mobility and geographical mobility. People are moving all the time, and that's part of how they're meeting each other. They're coming into, especially cities, and coming to know people in that colliding way that people do in cities. There are some specific technological inventions that make a difference. Mark Twain started writing on a typewriter. People gradually come to use different kinds of technology in making their work. And photography is important throughout the book. There are lots of photographers and people sitting for photographs. And the changes in photographic technology make a difference in those things, how quickly cameras could shoot, what size pictures they took, how photographers imagined themselves to be documenting the world. So those things matter, but in some ways, people stuck to very similar forms of communication all the way through. They talked to each other, they wrote letters, and they kind of knew each other in kind of intimate and immediate ways.
Hmm. Ulysses Grant studied drawing at West Point because generals had to have a grasp of the terrain and they had to map it out.
Yep.
It was a military skill.
And then
here again, we've got Matthew Brady on the scene during the Civil War, the coming of the medium of photography.
Taking pictures of battlefields. Yeah, and they used those pictures. It was during the Civil War that the War Department started to see that you could learn a lot from having a good photograph, and they actually sent people up in balloons to take larger photographs, which were the first aerial photographs in that war. So you can see that a lot. And then other later photographers who I wrote about, like Edward Steichen, also went to war and was among the first to take photographs from planes. And those kinds of things had a real military effect as well as an effect on the way that people saw the war.
Hmm. Walt Whitman saw photography as American, but he wasn't interested in it as historical record. What drew Whitman to the medium?
I think in a way, he did think of it as a historical record, but it was he sort of imagined a historical record that could be made out of photographs. Although he knew that there would have to be other things too, in a way. But I think the newness of it and the quickness of it, and also the democracy of it—that everybody could have his or her photograph taken—was so different than portrait painting, which had been reserved for the upper classes. And so suddenly, in that period, you have everybody getting dressed up and going to the daguerreotype studio or the photograph studio and having their picture taken. It's a completely different sense of who's valuable, who's worth having their picture taken.
Mm. Would you describe the photograph of Zora Neale Hurston that's in the book?
Sure, that's one of my favorites. That was taken by her friend Carl Van Vechten, who was also a friend of Gertrude Stein's and of Langston Hughes's. And he was a kind of amateur photographer who got very excited and started just collecting people, just taking everybody's photograph. She was a wonderful writer and had a very vivacious presence, which I think comes across in that picture. So you see her kind of laughing, and she has a hat with a feather in it, and I think looks very very much like she's sort of open to the world, which she was in that moment.
Yeah, I think Whitman would have liked that photograph.
I think that's true, actually. It's a nice observation.
Yeah. Let's move on to Twain and go back to him. I guess we've talked a little bit about him earlier in the interview. Mm. What would you like to say about Samuel Clemens? He appears a number of times in this book, A Chance Meeting.
Mm-hmm. It's true. I'm very fond of Twain, as I think many people are, and I think you find, going back to read him, that he kind of gives endlessly, that there's always more there than you than you realized. And when I was rereading him driving down the Mississippi, kind of looking again at Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer, which I had read in junior high school or whatever it was, and I loved without really understanding many of the things that were in them. So I think he's a person that people I know are somehow always reading one way and another. And he was a person, he was a very difficult person to write about, actually, because he's such a larger-than-life figure and has been written about so many times. It's hard to figure out how to find your way into talking about him in a way that will make him feel like a person instead of like a legend. But he was very warm in his friendships, very close to William Dean Howells, and their correspondence is beautiful to read and very funny also. So you start to see him in relation to other people, and that helps to see him as they saw him, at least.
Yeah. You know, after reading Howells and you know, thinking when he was a young man that Whitman was kind of out there, I was surprised to see Howells as an admirer of Twain. He called him the Lincoln of our literature.
He did. He loved his work. Well, I think the ways that Twain and Whitman were out there were a little different, because Twain is a really understood boyhood and politics. Those were things that he wrote brilliantly about. He doesn't write so much about sex. That's not really his subject. So he didn't frighten Howells in that way. And Howells had grown up in Ohio, also near a river, and one of his uncles had been a steamboat captain, and he really recognized the world that Twain came out of and the vernacular that Twain also loved. And so they did splendidly together. They really had a grand time.
Mm. It sounds to me like when you were researching and writing this, writing A Chance Meeting, that you had many chance meetings. You had chance meetings with people's correspondence, and one thing I would imagine led to you know, here, there, mm-hmm. you know, through one door and then into through another door. Give us some sense of what your life was like while you were working on this project, which took you a number of years. It must have been, you know, consuming.
It was consuming. It was in a very pleasurable way. I loved being in the world of this book and miss it now, actually, not to be working on it. But yeah, it was. I read between 300 and 400 books, so that was a lot. I was in books a lot of the time. And I started to read biographies by the index first, which is the sad sign of somebody who's looking for something in particular. And I was online a lot because there were a lot of period details that were online about ladies' uh-huh. hats and what kinds of carriages people had and who got into them first and all those kinds of things. And then I was really just, as you say, kind of in search of these different kinds of meetings. So reading through correspondence and thinking, oh, there's that person, so they did know each other, or finding a photograph, oh, paging through Avedon photographs and seeing a photograph of John Cage and thinking, oh, so Avedon photographed Cage, so that's, you know, that connection is made and I could do something with that. That was very exciting. It was quite a thrill to find many of those things.
I imagine these people showed up in your dreams on a regular basis.
They practically did, and I occasionally had to stop myself from talking about them as if I really did know them. You know, Willa Cather always says this, or because I felt all the time that I was talking, you know, near them, if not really to them.
Yeah. Did you have friends from time to time say, Rachel?
She's kind of been dead for a while.
Come out with us this evening.
Those kinds of things would happen. Yeah. But mostly my friends were very sympathetic, which was nice, because they had to hear quite a lot about all of these people.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned, you know, going back and finding out information about clothing and what the streets look like in a city. Maybe you would talk with us about some of the fun things that you learned about what these people did for entertainment. What kinds of entertainments did they enjoy?
Yeah, there were some nice things, especially I think earlier things would seem a little quaint to us, like it was so common to go for a walk as something that you did with a friend, or to take a carriage ride to look at a view. Those were activities, which we don't really think of as activities anymore. And then there were funny things also, like Carl Van Vechten and Langston Hughes meeting on the floor of a speakeasy and up in Harlem, and kind of, I mean, everybody just getting plastered and wildly dancing. And so there's quite a range of entertainment. Marianne Moore liked to go to baseball games and to fights. And there are other people who go to boxing matches in this. Norman Mailer and James Baldwin, I think, not accidentally had their final battle after a boxing match.
There's
quite a range, and all those things contribute to the way people understand each other.
The movies come along in this period of time.
Yeah, they do, which is part of the reason I was happy to have Charlie Chaplin along for the ride. Many of these people love the movies. W.E.B. Du Bois went to the movies all the time. So did Marianne Moore and Elizabeth Bishop. And it was another kind of narrative, which they also were excited about, and a visual understanding of the world, which many of the photographers I was writing about cared about, too.
Yeah. The people in this book who never met, if you could bring them, a group of them, together, who would you like to put together around a table?
That would be really fun. And another thing I think of is people who I would like for them to have known the work of people who came after them. You know, like I think Matthew Brady and Mark Twain, for different reasons, would have found Joseph Cornell's work really fascinating. I think Henry James would have been glad to know about the poetry that Elizabeth Bishop and Marianne Moore wrote, kind of thinking of him or trying to understand him. So in those ways, I also regret the missing historical connections.
Yeah. Boy, it could be quite a party, couldn't it?
It could be quite a party, yeah. There was a cartoon version of my book that ran in Newsday here that had everybody in a bar together. And it was really funny to see, Ulysses Grant next to James Baldwin, next to Edward Steichen.
Next to Bessie Smith.
Exactly.
What a lineup.
Yeah.
Very nice. I wonder, is that online?
I think it was online originally. It may still be online.
That would be fun.
It ran in March, I guess.
Now, I would imagine that you're doing a lot of interviews. I hope you are.
Thank you. Yeah. No, I have actually been very busy.
Yeah, yeah. And what have other interviewers been most interested in?
Some of the same things that you asked about, and people are often curious to know also like how I chose who to put in and who not to put in. There's always the question of if it's a party, you know, how did you make up the invitation list? And it's not only a party, I hasten to add, but
right.
But there is that question of how to make those decisions. And certainly I made some of them for the kinds of historical reasons that I was talking about. And also I made a lot of them out of an instinct for just who I felt I might be able to write about in a way that would make them vivid. And then I was interested in certain lines of influence, so I was also trying to put together the kinds of things you noticed, like Henry James sort of reemerging with James Baldwin, or I think in some ways the kind of humor of Mark Twain emerging again with Marcel Duchamp and John Cage.
Mm. Is there, looking back on it now, is there a person or persons that you now like to put in the book?
Oh, there were lots of people who I was sorry not to have in.
Yeah.
And there were all kinds of other lines I would like to have taken. I would have liked to write about photographers who were not portrait photographers, although I only wrote about portrait photographers. So then I would have written about Walker Evans because I love his work. But he didn't really fit in the world that I was making. And then there are all kinds of other people. I thought that it didn't make sense to write about painters in this way. I felt that these sort of short glimpses were not the way that you look at painting, that you have to go back and back to painting to really understand it. But had I had a form which made sense for painting, then I would love to have written about Mark Rothko or others of the abstract expressionists. So there were lots of people who I sorrowfully turned down.
Yeah. Now, has this project led you to what you're going to do next or what you're doing now?
I remain really interested in the conjunction of imagination and research, you know, in those sort of two projects, and certainly in biography and the kind of in making vivid historical characters. But I'm not quite sure what new form that will take. I'd like, since the essay form does allow you so many directions, I'd like to try something else. But I think I may actually try to move toward poets and painters for the next round.
Well, maybe we'll meet again.
That would be a huge pleasure.
Thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Rachel Cohen has been our guest in this portion of the program. She is the author of A Chance Meeting, Intertwined Lives of American Writers and Artists, 1854 to 1967. The book is published by Random House. It's 9 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, futures finished the day narrowly lower in the wheat pit. July contract, 366.5. Settlement price there at 363 was unchanged. That 66.5 was the high, by the way. The low at 359 for the July wheat. September contract, 376.5. The high, the low at 369. Settlement price at 372.75. That was a penny lower on the day. December contract off just a quarter of a cent. Had a high today of 387, a low at 380. Settlement price at 380. 3.75. Once again, it was off a quarter. The March off a quarter as well. 394 the high, the low at 388. Settlement price at 391.75, down 1/4. July corn now finished today 3.25 lower, 297. The settlement price had a high of $3.25, a low at 296.5 for the Julys. September futures, 303 the high, the low at 298.25. Settled 299, down 3.5 in the December contract. 302.75 high, low at 298.5. A settlement price for the December corn. This year new crop, 299.25, down 4.25 on the day. The March contract, 306.75 high, low at 303. Settled at 303.75. It was off 4 cents. May futures, 310.5 high, low at 306.75. Settled 307.25, down 4.5 cents. July futures, 310 the high, the low at 306.5. Settlement on that low at 306.5, down 4.75. In the September 2005 corn, 289.5 high, low at 289. Settled on the 289.5 high. It was still a penny and a half lower. And December futures for 2005, 273.5 the high, the low 272.5, and a settlement price on the low at 272.5, down a penny and a quarter in the December 2005 corn contract. July oats, 148.5 high, low at 144.25, settled 146.25, a penny and a half higher. And September, 153.5 high, low at 150, settled 152.25, and they were a penny and a half higher on the day. From the soy complex, the nearby July's 866 high, low at 844. Settled 852, up 3. August 818, the high, low at 797. Settled 804, down 3.5. September futures, 725, the high, the low at 706.5. Settled 715.5, 2.5 lower. November futures, 690, the high for the day. Low at 673.5. Settled 684, down 5.5 cents. January contract in the bean pit, 690, the high, the low at 678, settled 684.5, down 8.5 cents. In the March futures, they had a high, too, of 690, a low at 674 there. 685, the settlement price, down 4 cents. May contract for the beans, 682, the high, the low at 670. The May 2005 beans settled 679. They were down a nickel on the day. July bean meal, 273.50, high, low at 266.80, settled 268.70, unchanged. In the August meal, 262.50, high, low at 256.50, settled 258.40. They were down 110. July bean oil, 28.78, the high, the low at 28.32, settled 28.42, down 11. And the August bean oil, 28.28 high, low at 27.80, settled 27.81, and they were down 30 on the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Celeste?
Okay, Todd, it was a lower day today on the Mercantile Exchange. August feeder cattle, 109.90, the high 108.40, the low 108.50, the settlement that down 117.5. September, 108.72.5, the high 107 even, the low 107.02.5, the settlement that down 157.5. October, 107.85, the high. The low, 106 even. The settlement, 106.05. That down 145. June live cattle, today's high, 91.77.5. The low, 89.50. The settlement, 89.65. That down 155. July live cattle, 93 even. The high, 91.50. The low, 91.50. The settlement, that down 50. August live cattle, 91.35. The high, 88.80. The low, 88.90, the settlement, that down 222.5. June lean hog 79.75 and a half, the high 78.50, the low, the settlement 78.70, that down 60. July lean hog 77.75, the high 75.80, the low, the settlement 76.30, that down 115. August hogs 77.15, the high 75.55, the low, 75.65, the settlement, that down 152 and a half. October lean hogs 64.65, the high 63.55, the low 63.90, the settlement, that down 60. And July bellies 112.20, today's high 109.35, the low and the settlement, that down the limit, down $3. The Dow Jones Industrial Average currently up 21 points at 10,419. The NASDAQ up 1 at 2022. And the S&P 500 stands at 1141, up a half a point.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Illinois Farm Bureau, whose mission is to improve the economic well-being of agriculture and enrich the quality of farm family life. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Leonetti Aardvark from Pueblo, Colorado writes, Dear Dr. Science, I wrote you several months ago and asked why men's underwear has heavier elastic than women's underwear. Since you haven't answered, I can only assume that you are uncomfortable talking about underwear.
Nothing could be further from the truth. Since this is a family show, I'm reticent to say too much about women's underwear, but men's underwear, especially boxer shorts with polka dots or ducks, don't bring a blush to my cheek. Fact is, I haven't worn underwear since the early 50s, when I realized no one noticed if I did or didn't. With all the money I've saved not buying underwear, I was able to afford a whole set of novelty ties and permanent press lab coats in an exciting array of fluorescent colors. Hope I answered your question.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. To order the Dr. Science Get Smart Kit with new CD, screensaver for PCs, and a master's degree mouse pad, $21.95, call 800-989-DUCK.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers boxed lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655.
It's 1 minute before 2 o'clock. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the University of Illinois. Coming up, we'll have